This is Authors on Main, a partnership of Gibson's Bookstore, NHPR, and the Capital Center for the Arts, bringing world-class authors to Concord, New Hampshire. I'm Rebecca Lavoie. Jenny Lawson is the author of several best-selling books, but millions have known her for nearly two decades as The Bloggess, the voice behind one of the pioneering humor blogs in the modern era of the internet. In both her books and her blog, Lawson is cuttingly funny, sharing absurd stories from her life. She's also intensely vulnerable and incredibly transparent about her own struggles with chronic illness, mental health, and just trying to get through everyday life. Jenny joined me on stage to talk about How to Be Okay When Nothing is Okay, a book that combines her signature wit with practical advice on coping with so many things and getting over the fears and hurdles that might be holding you back. One note, this conversation contains some adult themes and a contextual mention of suicide. But it was much longer and even more profane than what you are about to hear. So if you want to check out an unedited, unbleeped version, you can do that. Just head over to nhpr.org/books or listen to the podcast NHPR Books on your favorite podcast app. Let's take a listen to Jenny Lawson, a.k.a. The Bloggess, on stage with me for Authors on Main. They like you. They really like you.
Holy sh**.
So, Jenny, I would love to start by, you have a very short passage of the book that you like to read. So why don't we start there and then we'll chat.
Okay. All right.
You okay?
This is fine. This is fine. Oh, okay. Like, I just want to say, first of all, I am so proud of every one of you because I know a lot of you deal with the same anxiety that I do. And it was really scary coming out here. And I've also been on this side of the audience where it is really scary walking in. So I am so proud of you. I'm so glad you're here. Thank you. I can't see any of you, but I hear you. I know there's at least people right here in the front. Okay. Murder potatoes. I sometimes struggle with the notion that everyone else has their together in ways I never will, and that I am too weird-looking, old, curvy, unsophisticated, etc. to leave the house. I have never owned brand-name shoes. Most of my clothes come from the internet and are chosen both for their ability to camouflage cat hair and their number of pockets. I don't know how makeup works, and the one time I tried to learn, I got intimidated by a mean 12-year-old at Sephora and ran away. Sometimes the insecurities I have about what I look like on the outside can be enough to keep me from doing the things that I want to do or make me self-conscious that I could ever fit in. And it is then that I remind myself of the hippo. Hippos look like enormous, doofy water babies who like long soaks, but really they're murder potatoes who kill over 500 people a year. It's true. They are literally deadlier than lions. And hippos are vegetarians, so they're not even doing it to eat you. They just want to kill you for fun, I assume. The point is, yes, hippos look like clumsy, sweet dummies who are too sluggish to get out of the pool, but inside, they are filled with rage and badassery and a terrific strength that almost everyone underestimates. Most people aspire to be a lion, sleek, and beautiful and noble, but consider these jiggly powerhouses. Sure, they look like the lazy goofs of the river and they can't swim because they're too heavy, but they can literally run faster than humans. They are so much more than how they appear at first glance. We just don't necessarily see it because hippos are baddies who have nothing to prove. And let me remind us both, neither do we. In a world full of wannabe lions, don't be afraid to love your inner hippo.
So, welcome to New Hampshire. Now, I just want you to know I once got fired from a job for reading your blog too much.
Yeah.
You, yeah. Tara Ariano, Sarah D. Bunting, I think of you as one of the founding mothers of snark on the internet. Is that fair?
That's very nice. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. So, to roll back in time, I'm sure you get asked about this all the time, so I'm sorry in advance. You went hyper-viral in 2010 for a blog you wrote. You know what I'm going to ask about, right?
About
Beyonce the chicken, yes. So do you still have Beyonce? Because I know she has seen some
Beyonce stays with me always.
Nice.
If I look out of my office, I can see her. She is rusty and she's falling apart, but so are the rest of us. And so I'm like, you go, girl, you're with me. You know, one of the things that's really funny about that story is I think a lot of people, they know the story, and for a lot of people, that's how they first found my blog. But what I didn't ever mention is the fact that, so, you know, it's me writing about my husband saying, like, you know, don't come home with towels. And I'm like, well, here's a giant metal chicken instead. And at the time, I thought it was really funny. But he was really mad. I mean, yeah. He was really. And so when it happened, I thought, this is going to make a really good blog post, but not now.
Yeah.
Because he's still mad. So I was like, I'm going to wait. And so he had to go to Hawaii for work, and he needed me to come and work with him. And so I was like, oh, this is when I'll do it, because he's busy with business stuff. And so I post it, and it goes viral, and my blog, you know, it crashes because there's too many people on it. And so I have to call IT, who is my husband. And I was like, look, something happened, and can you help? And he, you know, gets on, and he's like, what is going on? I was like, I don't know. Internet's crazy. Can you just fix it? And he, you know, gets it, and he figures it out, and then he sees, like, the picture of Beyonce pops up, and he was like, are you kidding me? Now, however, he's like, no, Beyonce is a part of our life.
Yes,
absolutely. Yes. But yeah.
So it's a marriage. I think that story is a marriage story. It's not a chicken story. It's a marriage story with the chicken present in the marriage. And I always think when I'm reading your work, especially when you write about your marriage, that your husband isn't just your husband. He's also a character in your stories.
Yeah.
So how do you think about that when you're living with a character in your story? And how do you think about that when something like that happens and this character goes really viral, but he's also a guy, you want him to put the toilet seat down, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So everybody that reads any, that's in any of my stuff, they have permission to say, I don't like that, take that down. Generally, he's the only person that I don't tend to show the stuff to first. Because first of all, he is very like, whatever, post whatever you want, but also because he's not a laugh out loud person.
Yeah.
He's one of these very, very, straight face. And in real life, he is much funnier than I am. And people always think that I say that, and then they spend time with us together and they're like, oh no, he is the funny one. And he is in real life, but on paper, I'm funnier. It works.
Well, you're
out.
Casting him as less funny than you on paper, too.
So. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm like, look, you're going to be the straight man here. I'm going to take all the good jokes. But I think it probably is a little bit difficult for your family when they become sort of, you know, in some ways bigger than themselves, in some ways smaller than themselves, because you're sharing 5% of your life. I have had people who have said, oh my gosh, your life is so funny. Crazy things are always happening to you. And yes, crazy things are always happening to me. But generally, like, this book took 5 years to write.
Yeah.
And most of my books take 5 years to write. So you can look at it and go, oh my gosh, something funny happened every day. But it may have taken 2 months to write, you know, a page.
Do crazy things happen to you, or do you find the absurd in what we would all see as normal?
I think first of all, it's easier for me to say yes to weird things because I can be like, okay, well, maybe this will make for an interesting idea or story. I think, though, mostly the thing that is happening is something that actually happens to lots of people, but I'm really good at stopping in the moment, and instead of being like, oh my God, that's really mortifying, I want to pretend that never happened. Instead, I'm like, well, this needs to go on the internet. I set fire to my clothes a couple of hours ago. And I think
Facts.
a normal person would be like, what the hell? How did that? And I'm like, well, I got to share this with the internet. Look, my clothes are literally on fire. What is happening? Yeah, I think if you just like take those things and hold them to your chest and celebrate them, it is so freeing. Because it's scary. It's scary and it's embarrassing, and being a human is terrifying and mortifying. But then as soon as you learn to say, look at this horrible thing that has happened to me, you welcome people in. And then once you welcome them in, then they're more likely to say, let me tell you the embarrassing thing that happened. And that's when I love you.
Right.
Like if you're like, oh, I've got my together, everything's perfect, let me tell you how I did everything right. I'm like, no.
Boring.
Exactly. Boring, intimidating, probably a liar. I don't want to have anything to do. But if you give me authenticity and embarrassment, and then all of a sudden I'm like, who are your top three favorite serial killers? You know, and
yeah.
You can get down.
Who are your top three favorite serial killers?
Oh my God, you
can just name one if you want.
I mean, H.H. Holmes is just all so right. fascinating.
Let's hear it for H.H. Holmes.
It's so fascinating.
That got weird fast.
Yeah, sorry.
So you put a lot of stuff on the internet, stuff that's absurd, stuff that's deeply personal. Do you ever have, and you write in this book that once you write it, it's out there forever. Do you ever have aspirational takesies, backsies wishes where you're like, kind of wish I didn't write that?
I have a lot of fear. And I have written before about the fact that when you write something, especially a book, it is frozen forever. And so what I try to think is this is a moment frozen in time that I may look at later and say, okay, I'm a different person now, or I'm a better person now. And I would hope that I'm the better person. I would hope that there's lots of stuff that I'm messing up now that I can say, oh, actually, I could learn from that. Oh, actually, I got that wrong. Oh, actually, I didn't understand. But yeah, very often I do wish that I could, like, let's pretend this never happened, for example. Sometimes I want to, like, tuck a little note in there that says, look, I know I talk all about how Victor is a Republican, but he's not that kind of a Republican. But, sometimes it just has to... It has to stand on its own as a slice of life and an idea that we are all continuing to learn. I do try to be really careful about not putting anything out that I might later think, am I not ready for that?
Yeah. You are so transparent about your health, about mental health, about things going on in your life that are difficult, that are dark. There's one point in this book, actually, like right in the middle, where you're like, I can't write right now, so I'll see you in a little while. How does that shift your relationship with your fans? Like, what do people say when they approach you? Is it parasocial? Is it social? Is it just like, tell me what that's like.
To me, it's social because, like, to me, parasocial is if you have somebody who is, like, very removed from the world and very, but I am quite out there. It's not unusual for me to say on threads, hey, it's 3 a.m. Will somebody just tell me it's going to be okay? Because I know it's going to be okay, but I would really like to have somebody say it to me. So to me, it's more social than parasocial. I really struggled with when I first wrote about depression and anxiety. My dad deals with mental health and he just said, do not do that. And this was, early 2000s. It was definitely not as common for people to share. I felt such cognitive dissonance because I would write this parenting blog on the Houston Chronicle that was very funny. And people would be like, oh my gosh, you're so funny. You have such a fun life. And meanwhile, those would be posts that I had saved up that, all I was doing was just clinging to the couch and breathing. And that's all I could do for that week. And so eventually I was like, I'm just going to put it out there. And I had so many people who, mostly anonymous, said, me too. Mm. And I thought I was the only one who heard those lies that depression tells. First of all, it was a wonderful gift for me because I felt left less alone. But one of the things that I think is really lovely is I've had so many people who, from that first years and years ago, who have come back and said, I was actively in the process of planning my suicide, and I decided to get help, not because of what I wrote, but because they saw 1,000 strangers saying, me too. I also sometimes think the world would be better off without me. And they read it, and they were like, how could anybody think that? And then they thought, well, if it's not true for them, maybe it's not true for me either. And what I think is both lovely and sad is that all of these total strangers in the comments saved people's lives, and they have no idea that they did it just by anonymously talking to a stranger and saying, "Me too. You're not alone."
We'll be right back with more of my conversation with Jenny Lawson live on stage in Concord, New Hampshire for Authors on Main. Authors on Main, taped live on stage at the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord, New Hampshire. I'm Rebecca Lavoy. Let's return to my chat with Jenny Lawson. Her latest book is How to Be Okay When Nothing is Okay. I want to congratulate you because a few days ago you wrote about one of your books being banned. Is that your?
Oh, yes.
You've entered like a... I know, it's not the first time. Yep. So... how does it feel to be so, like, verboten?
honestly, I mean, it is a mark of pride. I was not that upset about my book being banned because a little part of me, well, I have a lot of, you know, young readers who are like, you really helped me, you really saved me. I don't think there's anything in my book that, you know, a teenager would look at and go, oh no. But what was really upsetting is when I found out that the same high school library that had banned my book had banned 1,500 other ones, banned them or restricted them to only students who were in advanced placement literature. And those books were Crime and Punishment and Sense and Sensibility and Jane Austen and O Pioneers. And it's... Texas is heading down a real weird path, y'all.
What is your relationship like with Texas? Actually, that's something I'm always curious about with you.
I love Texas, and I think people have a strange idea about Texas because it seems very red, but actually it's quite purple. It is gerrymandered to hell.
Right.
It can be so upsetting when you look at who represents us, but if you look closer at the people who are in your life and who are in the community and who really exist, all of a sudden you're like, oh, there's so much more of us than there are of the people who hate and are afraid.
We got some really interesting questions from audience members, so I'm gonna pepper them in. We got a lot of questions about taxidermy. We got questions about taxidermy and questions about you buying haunted things. So you're a collector. Would you like to talk about what kind of collector you are and where you keep all this stuff?
I'm a massive collector of everything you can imagine, from a cabinet of curiosity stuff, of miniatures, of taxidermy, of tarot cards, of buttons, of... I mean, it is honestly, it's a little embarrassing. People come over to the house and they either are like, wow, or they're like, wow. We had a plumber in the other day, and he walked around, and he was like, man, you must really love your husband to let him put all this taxidermy up here. All of this taxidermy has, they have wigs on them. Yeah. Do you think that I'm...
they're posed, right?
Yeah, they're all dressed as ancient Victorian princesses. What is the... do you think I bedazzled this deer here that is... And all the taxidermy that I collect is... it's either something that died of natural causes, or it's lots of stuff that I buy at, like, old estate sales, or if it is something that looks horrifying... Victor is like, nope, not over there. Come over here. Look at what I see. There's something over. Look, over here. Come over. And that's when I know. I'm like, oh, we're running out of wall space.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of questions also about your writing process and how you write about struggling about writing. So I'm choosing this one. How do you tell the mean girl in your head to sit down and shut up long enough to write?
I remind myself that nobody else is going to tell the same story that I'm going to tell. Mm. And so if I'm going to do it, I might as well make it weirdly my own. Mm. Otherwise, it's going to be boring. Anybody can write something and then, you know, you take out all the stuff of like, oh, this might be embarrassing, or oh, this is not, everybody's going to understand that. But that's what makes it, I don't know, kind of boring. The other thing that I do is I talk to myself a lot, and this sounds ridiculous. I have friends who are like, oh, who doesn't talk to themselves? Everybody talks to themselves. No, no, no. I ask myself questions, and then I'm surprised at the answers. And I do it while I'm walking outside in my neighborhood.
Right.
And so when I'm really struggling with how do I write, how am I going to write this, and that blank page to me is very intimidating. So what I will do is I will take Dorothy Barker on a walk, and we will walk back and forth in front of the house. And as I'm walking, I will ask myself, what do you want to tell with this story? And then I'll say, okay, so here's what I'm thinking is. And at the same time, I have my audio on my notes app. And so it's transcribing everything I say. So I'm going off on it, and I'm like, oh, and you know what else? Oh, this theme and this. Oh, what about that? That would be a really funny joke. And oh, maybe I could do, oh. And then I keep going. And then about 30 minutes later, I walk inside and I upload that notes page to that empty page. Mm. And I have sort of an outline of, okay, here's what I want, and then it's less intimidating. Right. Or it's more intimidating because it's terrifying what it ends up with.
Yeah. So one of the things you talk about and about coping with ADHD that I really relate to is you talk about future Jenny. I think of a past Rebecca. I'm always like, I want to thank my past self for putting my keys here so I could find them right now. You separate yourself into today Jenny and future Jenny, and you're like, this problem is for future Jenny. So does future Jenny ever pissed at past Jenny for saving that problem for her?
No, future Jenny is very forgiving because because she's lived with past Jenny for a long time, and also because my memory is so bad that so often when I'm like, oh, I forgot to do that thing, I'm like, or did I?
Yeah.
I might have done it. I don't know. I have no idea when I'm screwing up. So sometimes when I'm screwing up, I'm like, maybe I didn't really screw up and I'm mad at myself for not screwing up, but really I did screw up and I've forgotten why I screwed up. It's very complicated. And I do feel bad for future Jenny, but that's future Jenny's problem.
Yeah. So how do you think about risk? Because you give the advice to take a risk every day. Did you take a risk today? Is it just this? Or
the whole day was a risk. Right. From the moment that I woke up, everything that I did was terrifying. But yeah, I try to go back to, there is a risk to everything. So there is a risk to, you know, even right before I came out, I was like, and now that I'm out here, I don't feel nervous at all.
Yeah.
Because I haven't gotten stuck at any, like, my anxiety is all about getting stuck. So, like, up until the moment before we walked out, I was like, what if I pass out?
Yeah.
What if I could have explosive diarrhea at any moment?
You could.
You
might.
You might, exactly. But once I'm out here, I'm like, nobody's going to know. It's fine. I love this. I love touring, and I love speaking, and I love meeting people. But I like it in groups of people who know me enough that if I have a panic attack, that they're going to be like, would you like a Xanax? And I could say, or a Klonopin. It's probably half and half with this audience. I know that if I needed to, if I started to have a panic attack and I said, hang on, and I like crawled behind the chair, literally you guys would be like, we got it. We'll talk amongst ourselves. Thank you. I mean, for real, clap for y'all. Y'all are the awesome ones. But that is how I have learned. These are things that I want to say yes to.
Right.
But the big stage with all the famous people and I'm like, no, I don't want to do that.
Right.
And I feel bad sometimes because I tell publicity, I'm like, I'm sorry. I know I'm supposed to want to do that, but that sounds not fun. I just want to do fun things.
Mm.
I don't have enough energy for not fun, you
right.
know?
Yeah, no, I know. One of the things you write about self-doubt is you talk about how the thing that you're doubting yourself about might be somebody's favorite thing later. Like, it's published and it's their favorite book, it's their favorite article. And you talk about the lack of relatability of Shakespeare, which I love. Do you think about relatability all the time? I mean, do you think that you're relatable? Do you think that you're not?
I always think that I am not. And I think that it can give you this weird idea that because maybe I don't fit with maybe the average person, that that means that nobody's going to understand me. But what I have learned is that that 5%, you don't see us out a lot because we hide, but when we get together, we are legion. And so when I start to think, this is a bridge too far, this is when people are going to say, oh, you've this is too scary, or this is too serious, or this is too ridiculous. I just think there's going to be one person out there who reads that one thing and says, oh my gosh, that spoke to me. When I, the first time that I wrote about having dermatillomania and trichotillomania, which is when you pick your skin or you pull your hair out, I was really afraid that people would be upset about it, because, and there's a lot of shame about it. And also, I think it can be kind of easy to be like, oh, depression, you're sad. I don't get it, but yeah, I get sadness. But then when you say, like, I intentionally pull out clumps of my hair, they're like, no, that's, oh, you've gone too far. We need to not support that level. I even have some family members who have said, you know, you shouldn't write about that. But what I've also found is that so many people later came up and said, not only you're one of the first people in real life that I know who also deals with it, but so many people come up and say, I didn't know there was a word for it.
Right.
And now I'm getting help. And now I know to talk to a therapist. And now it's not just my, like, shameful secret of why do I do this? Instead, it's, oh, this is why I do it. And this is how I can get better. And this is, I don't know. And you know, the same thing I have, where somebody will write something and it'll give me permission. So, like, Samantha Irby one time wrote this in one of her essays about having anxiety diarrhea on the side of the road. Oh. And she had to dig a hole in the snow to poop in. And ever since then, because sometimes when I get in a car, that's the first thing I think is like, oh no, what if I myself? I never have, but that's my thought. That is right. My immediate thought is like, do I have Imodium always on me? Yes, I do, but I'm still panicked about it. But then after I read that, I was like, okay, she got through it, found the funny in it. And once I read that, I immediately started writing an essay that I had always wanted to write, which was about cat trying to get into my bathroom while I had explosive diarrhea. And I have been so embarrassed about that story before. And then when I wrote it, people were like, that was my favorite story ever.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite story ever that you've written, a favorite piece of writing?
That is such a good question. I guess probably Stanley the Magical Squirrel. That was the first one. That was the first story.
For those who don't know, like, just give them a primer on Stanley.
So my dad is a absolutely insane. He's a kook, and he woke us up in the middle of the night, my sister and I think I was like 7, my sister was maybe 5, and he would always come home with, you know, live raccoons. We had bobcats in the house. We had tons of animals that he would nurse back to health, and he would, you know, rehab them. And so he was like, wake up, I have got a squirrel. And I'm like, squirrel, who cares? Like, yeah. That's not, you're waking me up for that? And he had it in a cracker box, and I was like, you're up those crackers. We're poor. Those are rich